So it's a pleasure today to have Sally Schrappner as our speaker for the Quantum Foundation seminar. And Sally will talk about quantum causal agents. And please keep your questions to the end of the talk. And whenever you want, Sally, you can start.
So I'm just changing the settings on the captions because I've been told there'll be captions of me speaking and it will be distracting.
Yes, you so should.
Okay. So thank you very much for inviting me to speak today. I'm a little bit disappointed I can't be there in person, but, you know, maybe sometime in the future I can come out to Perimeter and visit you all. Today I'm going to be presenting some work that's from a collaborative new research program that I'm involved in. We're looking at minimal causal agents. It's very early days for us, and so what I'm presenting today are just some of our first thoughts on this task. There's more detail included in the papers that I've listed here. The following one will be coming to an archive near you any moment now. And the one, Physical Grounds for Causal Perspectivalism, is due for a revamp, which again will be hitting the archive fairly soon. So this team's based at the University of Queensland. It's our postdoc, Michael Cumming, myself, a philosophy postdoc, Peter Evans, and Emeritus Professor Jared Milburn. So as you can see, there's a bit of gender imbalance there, and we're very keen to address that. So there'll be some postdoc and PhD positions available coming up. And so if you're female and interested, I'd encourage you to get in contact with me at the email address below. Okay. So the goal of this program is we want to be able to describe the physics of simple autonomous agents that have the capacity to learn cause-effect relationships. When such an agent has learned these causal relations, it'll be able to bring about certain ends by intervening in a specific manner. And of particular interest for us is how such agents would differ if they had access to quantum resources in addition to the usual classical resources. So how did this program come about? Well, I think anyone who's learned about Bell's theorem and seen the various Bell tests would agree that quantum mechanics has something very important to teach us about causation. Human beings seem to have very strong intuitions about causation, and Bergson's paradox aside, we're typically pretty good at identifying cause-effect relationships. And somehow these intuitions seem to fail in the case where we're trying to account for correlations between space-like separated quantum systems. So for me personally, I came to physics quite late in life, and I found the foundational consequences of Bell's theorem very confronting. So this has served as a big part of motivation for me. I'm interested in understanding about causation generally, and in particular, what quantum theory can teach us about causation. So as most of you know, computer scientists have been very hard at work in the last two decades trying to understand classical causation in their quest to build autonomous robots and to identify causal information in various complex situations where our intuitions are kind of limited. And I think it's fair to say that this is very far from being a completely solved problem. So while human beings, like this baby, seem to be able to identify cause-effect relations from very few examples, operating at very low energy costs in both supervised and unsupervised manners, we know that automated causal learning is really in its infancy. So many people here would be familiar with the modern extensions of Reichenbach's work that seek to identify common cause structures, the so-called causal modelling program of Pearl and others. And while mathematically this is a very beautiful theory, there are some problems when you try and apply this to real-world situations. So the methods tend to require many samples. They will struggle sometimes in the finite data setting. They're very vulnerable to hyperparameter tuning, so even the very modern methodologies where you kind of incorporate deep learning as well as structural causal models, there's always hyperparameters that you tune, and you find that depending on how you tune these hyperparameters, the causal structure can switch around. Because there are such a vast variety of methods, what we see is that there isn't any consensus. Typically, when you apply a different methodology to a particular data set, you'll often get different causal structure. And so the question is, maybe physicists can play a role in advancing this field. Perhaps there are some physical constraints that, when we properly understand them, will help us design better causal discovery algorithms. You might be forgiven for thinking that causal discovery is already a solved problem, given the extreme hype surrounding deep learning. But deep learning has some well-known problems. These models tend to identify spurious correlations. They tend to be vulnerable to adversarial examples. They're also vulnerable to domain shifts, and they fail to be robust to interventions. So just a couple of little examples to show you what I mean by this. This is some work that I did with some summer students where we built a bunch of convolutional neural networks, about 30, to try and identify the difference between a benign mole, so a benign classical, just a benign nevus, and a deadly melanoma. This is actually a really difficult task to do, even for well-trained doctors. They get around 80% accuracy. And there's been a large number of models that have come out claiming to be able to improve that accuracy, you know, up to the high 80s. So we built a bunch of these deep learning models, and we got kind of state-of-the-art accuracy on an unseen test set, around 87, 88% accuracy. It certainly did much better than I did at trying to differentiate between the two. But then we did some investigation of interpretability methods and saliency maps to try and look at what the model was basing the decisions on. So you can see in this first picture here, this is in fact a benign nevus, which is correct. So the model was correct. But when you look at what it was learning to, what it was using to base that decision on, you can see it was actually basing it on this dark corner of the image. So this is kind of a clue that the model had actually learnt the fact that, you know, there was some correlation in the training data between the existence of these edges and the presence of a nevus. Similarly, this example, you can see there's a little keratin flare here, which is just an artifact. But the models, although it's correctly identified this is a melanoma, it's identified this keratin flare, which is irrelevant. And another way that you can see the fact that deep learning models don't really capture causal information is that they don't tend to differentiate between background contextual information that we know is not causally relevant for the task at hand. So one way you can see that is that we cropped the corners because we realized that these models had learnt, you know, this spurious correlation. So we cropped the corners and the model changed its mind. So began to output this lesion classified as a melanoma. So we can see that these models aren't invariant to the kind of background contextual interventions that we would expect them to be. So what about identifying quantum causes? So as everyone knows, there's been a huge groundswell of work in this area in the last 5 years ago. And I wrote this paper with Fabio Costa back in 2016, where we developed some quantum analogues of the Markov condition, faithfulness condition, those kind of constraints that typically were used in the early causal modelling work by Judea Pearl, etc. There were very important precursors to this work, Giulio Chirabella's work and the Pavia group, Onya Nareshkov and Fabio and Czeslaw Bruckner and the Vienna group, Katja Reed's work. There were similar models that came out around the same time, Rob's group and with collaborators at Oxford, John Barrett. I'm sure you're all very familiar with this work. And of course, there's been literally hundreds of papers looking at this kind of process matrix approach to identifying quantum causes. I guess for me, one of the problems with this approach is very abstract. It's device dependent, but also the discovery techniques don't tend to scale well. So we're kind of also in that problem, back in that area that we have in the classical causal literature, where it just seems like the constraints that we're using perhaps aren't enough to capture and identify causes in at least the way that humans do. And importantly, we just completely abstract the role of the agent away from this. One of the things that I did to try and improve these causal discovery techniques was look at using classical machine learning techniques to try and improve these last two papers, are just some of that work. While you can do that in certain circumstances, the problems are, you know, these are supervised learning settings. So you've either got to have really good simulations or very good experimental control to get your training data to train on in the first place so that you can then learn unknown processes. So this led to this new work, which is where we think about understanding causation from the perspective of an agent. Can we talk about the physics of a learning agent? So there's a very long tradition in the history of philosophy of regarding causation from the perspective of an agent. So rather than causal relations just being something out there in the ontology of the world, we consider it as potentially a property that's projected onto the world by agents like ourselves that possess a particular time orientation and thermodynamic bias. So from a physics perspective then, we can ask ourselves if it's possible to explore this question by considering the physics of learning agent. So as you can imagine, human beings are very messy and complex and extremely difficult to model from a physics perspective. So this inspired us to come up with the idea of a very minimal causal agent where we could start to think about actually constructing something from engineering pieces that we know how to do today so that we can have a think about how to describe those from physics. And with such an agent in hand, perhaps it will be possible for us to understand better, for example, fundamental sources of causal asymmetry, what the differences are between quantum and classical causal agents. So we have some desiderata. We assume our minimal causal agent to be finite. It needs to be open. It needs to be maintained in a far from equilibrium steady state. It's stabilized by a low entropy source of energy, and it contains some special subsystems, some actuators that can do work on the world and perform our interventions, some sensors that can detect the changes in the world that are caused by these interventions, a memory to collect the records of actuator and sensors, and a learning process to identify the causal relationships between these records. Now, you could probably argue that we don't, strictly speaking, need a memory, and perhaps that what the memory can be is just simply the physics, you know, the actual physical state of the learning machine. But we haven't really explored that question particularly in this first kind of run. And of course, this kind of little Lego block model gives us the potential to be able to split out parts that are quantum and parts that are classical and see how they differ. Now, the first thing you might ask is, why do we need to have this maintained in a far from equilibrium steady state? I think it's fairly obvious that if you have an agent that's in thermal equilibrium with its world, then you're not going to be able to, your actuator is just going to effectively be a random number generator, and same with the sensor, you're not going to be able to extract any information from the world. So clearly this little schematic here is not new. Every robot ever built can probably be described by this kind of simple schematic. From a physics literature perspective, Hans Frege's projective simulation model is probably the most relevant, although the detail there is really in the learning machine. What we're interested in today, however, is not how to implement the learning machine algorithmically, like Hans has done in the projective simulation model, but rather as a physical system so that we can say something specific about the thermodynamics of causal learning. So in the first instance, we're just going to look at a simple example of a learning agent where we have the potential to replace actuators and sensors with quantum resources. So we imagine an all-optical agent that uses the temporal profile of light to probe an external environment. It consists solely, so our environment, our world, consists solely of an optical cavity with a specific fixed line width and detuning with respect to the pulse carrier frequency. So this environment unitarily will transform the pulse. So while we haven't coupled the learning system to the actuator in this simple model, so in this simple model, we're just assuming that the actuator will send out a pulse, the world does this unitary transformation, and the sensor detects this incoming pulse. We can actually imagine, there is potential here to feedback information across these two control fields. So we model both the actuator and the sensor using a three-level system with a Raman transition. We have an optical cavity for the actuator, a three-level system and a Raman transition. The ground and excited states are coupled by a virtual transition that's controlled by this classical electrical field. And we assume the atom initially starts in the ground state, ends up in the excited state, and will emit a photon that has a temporal shape that is controlled by this classical electrical field. In the case of a quantum actuator, we consider a single photon Fock state. In the classical case, we consider a weak coherent state. So for the single Fock state, we know that there is definitely a single photon at each run. In the classical case, we use a weak coherent state where just the average photon number is one. So there'll be some fluctuation in intensity due to Poisson statistics. So the sensor here is just the reverse of this process. A photon is absorbed, sending the atom from the excited to the ground state. And this transition is controlled again by a classical field. So when this classical field, which is parameterized by a particular line width and detuning, exactly matches the cavity of the world, so the environmental field, this photon will be perfectly absorbed. So the probability that you will find this atom in the ground state is a function of this variable gamma, which is an overlap between the temporal shape of the incoming pulse and the control field. We can actually calculate the probability that you will find this atom in the ground state following absorption of a photon. Here, eta is the quantum efficiency of the detector, kappa is the decay rate of the cavity, and this Tansch function is a term that just relates the thermodynamic properties of the cavity. So when you're in a high state, this Tansch function approaches zero. When you're in a low temperature state, it goes to one. So when we calculate the probability for the atom being found in the ground state, with respect to the classical example, we need to include this exponential term to account for those fluctuations of Poisson statistics. And it's actually this difference that really plays a difference in the way that the agent can learn. So with learning, we have a feedback system here. So we feed in this probability distribution of the atom being in the ground state into some central processing, and we feed back to change the parameters of this cavity to try and optimize the absorption of this photon. So we need some update rule to minimize the error rate. So F here parameterizes the control pulse. The rate at which errors are occurring is equal to the dot product of the rate at which you change your control field parameters and the gradient of the probability space with respect to those parameters. And we just kind of implement a kind of gradient descent. So here's a little schematic of learning in this agent. So you can see the solid lines were where we use the Fock state, the quantum agent, and the dashed lines are where we use the classical coherent weak light. This is just a difference between the estimated parameters of the agent and the true parameters of the external world cavity that's been normalized. And you can see here that in the low temperature environment, so the zero temperature environment, the actuators have very few errors and learn very quickly. And as the temperature goes up, you know, understandably, there's some more noise and the agent learning is less efficient. So what can we say about the thermodynamics of this little model? So as the agent learns, more photons are absorbed by the sensor and therefore we have less heat is dissipated back into the environment. So from the perspective of thinking of this agent as a little thermodynamic engine, the learning process itself will maximize the conversion of work from the actuator into actually useful information. You can actually quantify this using the Jasinski equality and identify that the change in free energy of the sensors is also maximized by learning. So we did all that in this paper here. And Mile Gu and co-authors have a really lovely paper where they did something similar, just in a classical learning model, but they looked at thermodynamic learning and were able to show again that you can kind of maximize work production as learning is optimized. So as our learning, you know, in this model that I just showed you, the all optical model, you know, the learning machine was very simple. As learning gets more complex, we might want to think more carefully about the actual learning machine that we would have in our agent and how we can implement this physically. So most of you will be familiar with this kind of diagram. It's a perceptron. Perceptrons are a basic unit of learning that were designed to algorithmically simulate basic physical neurons in the brain, so physical processes occurring in the brain. And this is the building block of most neural networks and deep learning neural networks, convolutional neural networks, recurrent neural networks, etc. So the way it works is you have an input here. So for example, this might be a vector of pixel values for an image. You weight them by these factors W, you sum them and pass them through some non-linear activation function. This could be a sigmoid function, a ReLU. This will give you some binary output, which you then compare to the true labels, which gives you an error signal, which in an algorithmic sense you pass back to change the weights. You know, this is done by backpropagation algorithmically. So we all know that we can implement this structure algorithmically. That's what's done today. It's very hard to estimate the thermodynamic cost of an algorithm. But one thing that we do know is that the algorithmic cost of these neural networks is extremely high. And that's kind of surprising, I guess, particularly given the fact that it's modeled on the brain and the brain operates at around 100 watts of power. So here we will ask ourselves what a physically implemented perceptron might look like. Can we characterize the thermodynamics of this physical process involved in learning? And if we have access to quantum resources, are there potentially any advantages to improve on this thermodynamic cost of learning? So the key process to model is this activation switch. And one way that you can model that is using a double well Smoluchowski process. So the nice thing about this model is that we can see it's a nonlinear dissipative system which is stabilized by an external source of free energy, and that is, it will require work to keep it running. So it consists of an energy potential that can be biased in one direction or other, and the particle position here is, you know, determines the output of the switch. So the first thing that you can see is that this switch won't function without some friction. So if you change the bias, if you're wanting to output, let's say this is a one and this is a zero, and you want to output a zero instead of a one, and you change the bias. If there's no friction in this model, then this particle is going to kind of slosh around indefinitely and never settle down into one state or the other. We know that there needs to be some friction in this model. We also know that this results in dissipation. And we know by the fluctuation dissipation theorems that we can't have any friction without the system then experiencing some random fluctuations. In the classical case, we typically think of this as thermal noise. And so we can ask ourselves how this noise that necessarily will be in the system can affect the performance of our system. So let's now, just this bottom plot here is just showing the error probability the particle being in one side or the other. And you can see because of these fluctuations and this bit of thermal noise that there is a little bit of error probability that the particle will jump over to the other well due to this thermal noise. So we can actually model a steady state response curve to give you an idea of the average behavior for an ensemble of these processes. So here what we're seeing is the averaged estimated output for different values of the noise as we linearly ramp the bias from one side to the other. So as you dial back the noise, you can see, so we're decreasing the noise, you can see that we have a more definite switch with a kind of typical sigmoidal function that we implement algorithmically. Of course, this kind of steady state response curve doesn't tell you what happens in any individual switch. We can, in fact, model the function of an individual switch using stochastic Itô equations, differential equations. And again, we can look at what happens as you reduce the noise in this model. So in this first example, where the noise is relatively high, you can see, so what we've modeled here are just three examples of a single process switching. There's an orange, a blue, and a green. And you can see when the noise is very high that the switching occurs very early. But you can see even like with this orange one, it switches to the one state, back to the zero state, back to the one state, and then onwards. And as you reduce the noise, while you get a more kind of a sharper sigmoidal function, it actually increases the time taken to switch. So in this final example where the noise is extremely low, two of the perceptrons actually don't even switch in this in this time limit that we're looking at. We only have a single switch. So by that way, you can see that there's kind of a trade-off between the level of noise and the learning rate that will be inherent in your system. So as anyone who's trained a neural network will know, typically we tune hyperparameters that correspond to these physical parameters by hand. So we inject noise in the form of dropout, we add friction terms, we use momentum, we change the learning rate. And interestingly, we typically tune these parameters independently of one another, but in a real physical system, we can see that these parameters are intrinsically linked through fluctuation, dissipation relations and thermodynamic considerations. So now we're going to add one more element to our perceptron. Instead of using a fixed point steady state process that will characterize the learning, we're actually going to think about using a limit cycle. So the way that you use a limit cycle is you imagine that instead of considering that the activation function has switched when the particle is in, you know, the left or the right side, you consider that the activation function has switched when a limit cycle appears. So at some level of applying a bias in your system, there'll be a hop bifurcation and a limit cycle will appear. Why would we consider doing that? So for one reason, this emulates a neural spiking processes in our brain. There's been a fair bit of work done in biology to show that you can describe neuronal spiking processes using limit cycles. But the other reason is that, you'll see the other reasons why we might want to do this. So one way that we can model the dynamics is to use a Van der Pol oscillator and again simulate the dynamics. So what you can see here is we've graphed the dissipation where the energy is dissipated around a single cycle around the limit cycle. So each of these steps that you see here is just the amount of energy that is dissipated as the limit cycle goes through one full circuit. So we can see that there's two biases here. There's the fixed point before we see the hop bifurcation. Of course, this is just zero energy dissipated here. The system is just sitting there in its fixed state. And then once we ramp up the bias, we'll get to a point where the limit cycle appears and these little energy dissipation steps appear. So you can see that there's... this limit cycle we can think of as a kind of clock where each of these steps is regarded as the tick of a clock. Most of the work here is captured in this really lovely paper that Jared wrote around the thermodynamics of clocks. He looks at limit cycles, clocks forming limit cycles in both classical and quantum cases. So most of what I say in the next bit comes from this paper. So to register that this perceptron has switched, obviously you don't want to wait for too many ticks of this clock, you'll set some threshold value. So we might say that, you know, once there's, you know, this amount of energy dissipated, we assume that there's been a certain number of ticks of the clock and the perceptron we regard as having switched into the active mode. So this, the amount of energy that's dissipated is what's then fed back in to tune the weights of the learning model. So obviously there's some variation in between each of these ticks. This is actually due to phase noise. And this phase noise can in fact be minimized by increasing the size of the limit cycle. So with large driving and large dissipation, you can reduce this noise. And again, you can see that this will translate directly into learning rates. And importantly, you can reduce this kind of noise independently of the temperature of the bath. So this is just a plot here of some examples of this kind of switching which uses limit cycles to characterize when the activation switch has switched. So if you just look at the momentum variable, it looks pretty random. If you actually measure the energy dissipated though, you can see these kind of little step functions that are capturing the fact that we're in this limit cycle. So the degree of noise determines how long you need to let the system run before you can confidently say that there's been a switch and an output that you want to feed back to adjust the weights. So what are some take-homes of this when we go over to the quantum case? So you can actually implement these kind of little perceptrons using quantum nanoclocks. At zero temperature, of course, though, there'll be no longer thermal noise in these models. And as we saw earlier, if there's no longer thermal noise and it's a classical system, then the learning will stop. You need some thermal noise to get you out of local minima. But in the quantum case, even at zero temperature, in the zero temperature limit, there will be some noise. The only noise is this kind of phase noise that you saw, and the origin is purely quantum phenomena like tunneling or spontaneous emission. So zero temperature sounds like a bit of a strange thing, but I have learned that this, you can do this at optical frequencies. You can operate at zero temperature quite easily. So there is an opportunity here to build networks of perceptrons to form quantum nanoclocks that can run at very low power. So the summary of the talk so far is that we can see in our little simple minimal causal learning agent that the accuracy of the learning for the model according to the accuracy of the sensors and actuators is limited by noise. So in the quantum case, the noise is basically limited by quantum noise. And we can see that there'll be an advantage, and you can really port anything from the literature on, you know, metrological advantages using quantum systems over to making claims about learning using sensors and actuators in this model. We also saw that the ability to learn, however, actually does require some noise. And in the quantum case, we can see that there are some improvements because we can operate at the zero temperature limit, and we can therefore operate at very low power. So now we come to the extremely speculative part of this talk. What we want to think about is the arrow of causation and whether we can relate anything that we've learnt to making some claims about the arrow of thermodynamics, the arrow of learning, the arrow of time, and whether or not we can see why perhaps these arrows might be aligned. So when we think about the arrow of causation, this particular little minimal learning model, it's kind of put in by hand by the fact that we design the agent to have actuators which can perform interventions on the world. And we describe that thermodynamically by saying that the actuator can perform work on the world. And we design the sensors so that they are activated by receiving work. So the world does work on the sensors, and that's what triggers them to record a change in the world. So there is a kind of built-in asymmetry here. Do interventions come before sensations? We don't necessarily have to think of that. In fact, if you think about it, to actually perform an intervention on a system, you have to know something about that system first. So before you can decide to set a variable to a particular value, you have to measure it to see what the value is. So perhaps rather than thinking, you know, the process starts with an intervention and then a sensation, you could actually argue, well, maybe we actually need to measure the world first and then perform the actuator. This is a kind of chicken and egg problem. And like the philosopher Daniel Dennett says, you know, whenever you have a chicken and egg problem, the answer is yes, which just means that it doesn't really matter. You can kind of bootstrap your way to a consistent story starting from either of these. But we can see that there is some kind of thermodynamic asymmetry built into this model. So agents, as we said, an agent that is at thermodynamic equilibrium with its environment won't be able to learn. These would just function as kind of random number generators. And we've seen that learning actually will necessarily increase the entropy of the environment. So learning systems will always dissipate heat into the environment. So we could argue then that a universe in which an agent like this learns causally, the universe will always appear to those agents to be increasing in entropy, because as the agent learns, the entropy of the environment increases. And my understanding is this fits to some extent with Ravelli's thermal time hypothesis, but I'm interested in question time to hear what people think about that. We can ask ourselves, what happens if we reverse the thermodynamic arrow of this learning process? If you reverse the thermodynamic process of the learning machine, it kind of won't learn. I mean, learning just is lowering the entropy. of you know, the information that's coming in. So the data that you might have, for example, when you start, before you learn, you don't know anything, you know, the entropy, you assume that maximal entropy over that data set. At the end of the learning process, you know, your entropy has been lowered. So reversing the thermodynamic gradient of a learning machine really stops it from being a learning machine. What about the temporal arrow? This is a little bit more difficult. We might ask ourselves, where is time for this learning agent? Well, we can think in the first place about some limits to the learning rate of this agent. There is some refractory period of the sensors and actuators. I didn't talk about it much in this talk, but you can imagine that the actuators actually need to be in a kind of ready state before they can fire off. So I think in our little optical model, you know, the actuators, the atom needed to be in the ground state. So there is some, you know, after an actuator fires off, there'll be some refractory period where it needs to reset. And the rate of this refractory period will limit to some extent the rate of change that the agent is going to be able to perceive in the world. Similarly, the rate at which the learning machine converges will also be another rate limiting feature of the model. So far, I've imagined just a static environment, but we can, of course, imagine an environment that's changing. So a world where instead of it being a fixed optical cavity, you can have a cavity where the line width or detuning with respect to the carrier frequency changes. And of course, the rate at which the learning system will settle into a steady state must exceed the rate at which the environment is changing, or the learning agent, the causal agent, will never see these processes. We can also then ask ourselves, does this agent actually need an internal concept of time? And I think one of the things that we can do is that we can think about here whether or not we actually need an internal clock. So the only thing really that the agent needs is it needs to be able to coordinate sensor and actuator records. So it needs some way of knowing when it performs an actuation that the next sensation is the relevant one to consider. So there needs to be some coupling between these. And you could imagine, you know, any nonlinear oscillating limit cycle within the agent acting as a clock that can coordinate these two time signals. So in that way, the time for this agent is a purely relative concept, a purely relational concept, where it's a relation between kind of limit cycles that are occurring within the agent. I find it very difficult to think of limit cycles without thinking about time. I believe that there are ways using Poincaré sections, et cetera, that you can think about them in just from a geometric perspective. This is work that we haven't done yet, but this is obviously an interesting direction to take. And I did speak about this. This was just talking about the arrow of intervention or action. Now, there is a fair bit of literature in the philosophy canon, which talks about the direction of deliberation. So there's a saying that deliberation crowds out action. So if you're thinking about what you're going to do, in some way the action is not determined. Even probabilistically, you can't assign a probability to a particular action occurring if you allow for the prospect of deliberation. Frank Ramsey was perhaps one of the first people in kind of the 1920s in Cambridge to come up with this kind of problem. We haven't actually addressed this at all in our work so far, but this is something that we do want to look at in the future. It's difficult because, you know, what we really need then is another piece of the puzzle, which would be an emulator where the agent can not only, you know, automatically learn what actuators are the right ones to do to optimize the sensor reading, etc., but actually needs to be able to imagine what will happen with a variety of different outputs. And this fits with Hans Breguel's projective simulation. That's one of the motivations for his approach. And so there is some opportunity here to combine the two. So just to finish off, the summary is we've given a very simple sketch of a minimal causal agent. We know that they can't be in thermal equilibrium with their environment. They need to be far from equilibrium, steady states that are stabilized by external energy sources. This necessarily implies that there'll be dissipation and therefore fluctuations, And we can understand that these will be constrained by the laws of thermodynamics. And we've seen that possibly we can think that maybe time can be relational and local to an agent. And I'll finish there. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Sally, for the talk. And so are there questions?
It's very interesting, and I think I have to think about everything you said more deeply. Have you looked at pairs of agents and how they come to agree or disagree with one another, looking at the same world, so to speak?
Thanks, Lucien. That is a great question. And we've thought about it only in very speculative sense. So one of the obvious things that we want to do with our optical agents is think about whether or not they can communicate with each other. And I think that, you know, they're obviously when we're thinking about whether time can be relational and local to the agent, as soon as you introduce the possibility of communication and the direction of communication with multiple agents, then you're kind of in the position of being able to think about a global time as an emergent property of these communicating agents, and then ask yourself that kind of directionality. So no, we haven't done any work on that, but that is certainly something that we're looking at to do next.
So the communication would be a sort of symbolic language that they would use to talk to one another. So would it be more than just observing the same world, but actually having some means to communicate?
There's a couple of different things that you can think about. So one of them is it important in this story for an agent to be able to recognize another agent as an agent, rather than just some other piece of the world? And if you want to think about it from that perspective, then I think you do need to come up with a kind of shared language or some way of the agent recognizing that it's communicating with another agent and not just some, you know, static optical cavity, whatever it is that you want to think about as the world. So then you do need to start thinking about a shared language. Obviously you can take this story very far, and then you can think about how do you learn languages, and you can look at you know, there's a whole lot of literature there in the, you know, Bob Kirker's stuff with learning quantum languages, etc., that you can explore. But I think the communication part is interesting, even if you don't go that far of thinking about do they need to recognize each other as agents, do they need to have a shared language, etc. Just thinking about emergent properties once you have collections of agents that can communicate, I think, is an interesting story. And there probably are some things that you can do with fairly simple systems.
Okay, thanks, very interesting.
So we have a question from Ding and then from Rob.
Hi, Zoli. I'd like to talk about, I guess my question is, there's an important part of your talk I missed. So you mentioned, learning needs noise. Could you explain again, maybe in the simplest terms possible, why?
The simplest thing is to think of it like this. So this is kind of the logic of the argument. You can't have a learning agent that's in thermal equilibrium. So it needs to be in a far from equilibrium steady state. For it to be in a far from equilibrium steady state, you need to be driving it with some energy source. If you're driving a system with energy, if you just keep pumping energy in, eventually it's going to blow up. You need some way of dissipating the energy. So if you have dissipation, then you're necessarily, by the fluctuation dissipation theorems, going to have noise. And you can think of those, you know, you can think of specific examples like Brownian motion and go back to, you know, Einstein's derivation, or you can think of, you know, more modern far from equilibrium thermodynamic fluctuation theorems, the Jagiinski equality, Crookes theorem, that kind of work to try and characterize and understand that. So that's really the logic of the argument.
So is this related to the statement that I have memory and I record new pieces of information in the memory, although for my memory system, the entropy decreases. For the global system, the entropy has to increase. Is this related?
I think that's another way you can think about it. I said at the start, I'm not sure if you were at the start, but I did comment on the fact that, you know, in the first run of this, we separated out a memory and the learning system. But I'm not sure that you need to do that. I think that it might actually be that you can capture memory in the physical states of the learning system itself, in which case I'm not sure whether that changes the answer to your question. I mean, in which case you're still lowering the entropy of that system, and you need to dissipate heat to do that. So there will be fluctuation and noise. So I guess the answer is yes. Requiring a memory similarly requires that, you know, you're reducing entropy and therefore you'll be dumping heat into the environment.
Thank you.
Rob, you had a question?
Yeah, thanks. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Rob.
So I'm trying to connect up the bulk of what you said in the later parts of the talk with kind of the motivation you started with. So my understanding of much of what you said is sort of, you know, this is an investigation of the sort of physical limitations on learning when learning sort of understood in a particular way. And it didn't seem that it was necessarily specific to learning about causal structures out in the world. It was sort of more like the learning process itself involves causal relations between the learner and the world and so on. So there was a lot of nice stuff about the sort of physics of learning and kind of, you know, trade-offs in terms of rates of learning. But I'm just curious, in the beginning you said, quantum mechanics poses a challenge to sort of causal explanations of correlations we see out in the world. And you sort of expressed some doubts about whether quantum causal modeling could really be made to work. And then you said, and so we're going to look at the agent, but I kind of felt like we never closed the circle and said, okay, so now we have this model of the physics of learning. How does that help us, for example, determine the causal relations between systems out in the world? How does it help us build better causal discovery algorithms?
Absolutely. So we're definitely not there yet. And I'm still not sleeping because of Bell's theorem. So in this talk, there was no answer to that problem. I think the way that I see it, though, is that the one thing that's missing from the causal modeling program is a kind of understanding of the role that intervention plays. We talk about, you know, they're just quantum instruments and CP maps. And I guess what I was trying to get at with this model was inherent in the model is you have to have actuators, you have to have ways of changing the world, of intervening on the world. And there has to be this cycle of making an action, changing the world, and then getting information back from the world about what there is. In that way, you can build maps of what you can cause. And in that way, you can then build maps of what natural causes there are, what other things can cause, you know, what variables can cause each other. So it's a kind of precursor to that whole next step of trying to relate variables out there in the world causally, is you actually need to be able to measure and control things. So maybe if you think about it as just a single node in a quantum DAG or in a classical DAG, just, you know, a single node, and what you're trying to do is go, okay, what can I say about setting this node to a particular value and getting information back about when I do that and when I change the world in that way and getting information back. You know, that's the first step before you can do that for multiple variables and then try and construct maps of how they're related to each other. And I think that kind of is at the heart of the whole philosophical program of agent-based causation. It kind of says, you know, it starts with us. It starts with the fact that we believe that we can intervene on the world in a way that is independent of the laws of the world. So we assume when we do experiments, when we set and control variables, that there are laws that are invariant that govern what happens, and that we can do this and get information back that is reliable and robust. So that's a bit of a long-winded answer. The short answer is, no, I don't know yet. But the kind of motivation is to try and see what extra perspectives we get when we try and, you know, integrate this agent perspective.
So let me see if I can restate my understanding of what you're saying, and you can correct me if I've got it wrong, which is, like, suppose you wanted to follow Pearl's lead, and in particular take a kind of interventionist notion of causation as fundamental, but you wanted to do it in a quantum sphere. Mm-hmm. Then to sort of get started, you know, you would need to have, for example, an analog of Perl's do conditional, and which relies on the notion of, you know, being able to intervene on a classical variable and set it to a particular value and being able to measure the value of another variable. And so you could say, well, you know, right there at step one, even trying to define what a do conditional is, you know, in a quantum world, you need to, figure out what that means. Like, you know, what does it mean to, you don't just set the value of a variable anymore. An intervention is something different in a quantum world. And you don't really have a notion of passive, maximally informative measurement anymore either, because you have many incompatible measurements. So is it sort of like at the level of even the basic conceptual building blocks of Perl's whole causal discovery framework kind of have to be reconsidered? And this project is kind of in preparation for, you know, figuring out what the right building blocks are.
That's a great way of putting it. And I think that idea of, you know, the Perl framework that abstracts away what we actually do when we intervene and set variables might be hiding something that's quite important. And particularly in the quantum case, I didn't say anything about this in this talk, but clearly measuring has a very, and what you choose to measure has some very special properties when we think about quantum systems. And it's interesting that the limit cycles and the quantum clocks that I was talking about, you won't, depending on what you measure, you won't actually see the limit cycles in a quantum system. And that will have implications for how we think about acquiring causal knowledge. So Jared and I wrote a paper a while ago in about 2018, which was called Classical and Quantum Causal Interventions, or Classical or Quantum and Classical Causal Interventions, something like that, where we tried to actually go, let's just look at the physics of an intervention. And we made some claims in there about the fact that, you know, to do an intervention, you need to measure the system first. You can never do a perfect measurement unless you have a kind of zero entropy source. You know, your measuring apparatus has zero entropy, and we know that's kind of impossible. So there is no such thing as a perfect intervention in the Perl sense. I don't mean to claim that the quantum causal modeling program as it exists is not useful. I think there's so much insight that I've gained from everything that people have written, and I think that's a program that should still continue. I'm just saying that this is kind of an alternative approach that we can take, and hopefully the programs will meet somewhere in the middle at some point.
Maybe just a short follow-up, which is, am I right in thinking that what you've done could also be considered kind of a deeper analysis of intervention and measurement, even in a classical causal modeling framework? So you could say, well, you know, Perl stuff is all fine and good, but in the real world, you know, you don't intervene perfectly and you don't measure perfectly, and you need a framework that can take that into account.
Definitely. And that, you know, if we're thinking of physical systems, which, you know, presumably Perl's causal modeling, we assume that this is embedded in the real world that can be described by physics, then we should be able to describe those interventions in language that physicists will understand. And maybe there are some thermodynamic constraints at play that we can use to actually further constrain the causal models and therefore make them more easily identifiable. So that is, you know, very speculative. I don't see how to do that, but that's the kind of thinking.
Okay, thanks.
Ding, you have another question?
Yes, thanks, Flaminia. So I'm still trying to understand your first point, Sally. You want mm-hmm. a minimal causal agent model. I'm not sure. So just now you mentioned you treat memory and the learning system as separate elements. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're using the learning system in a technical sense, and I haven't studied. Naively, I would expect that you know, if you have a sensor and you gather some information and register it in the memory, That to me sounds like learning, but maybe it means something different than the learning system.
I guess what we want is we don't just want it to register and put it in a memory, but we want it to be able, we want the causal agent to be able to use those sensations to be able to predict how things will change under certain interventions. So there needs to be a relationship between the sensor records and the actuator records so that the machine can learn, you know, what the world is telling it about, you know, how to identify causal pathways in the world. So, you know, you could say, I mean, you could say, let's just forget the learning. Let's just say maybe what you want to do is somehow minimize the distance between memory records, between the actuator and the sensor. So let's say you want to just maximize the mutual information between sensor records and actuator records. I guess you could call that a kind of learning. And then, you know, you'd just have some distance metric that you'd need to be able to measure and minimize. And maybe that would be a minimal causal agent. It would be fairly limited though, because I guess all you'd ever be doing is just kind of matching actions to sensations. Whereas what you want to be able to do is be able to learn how to change, you know, how to change sensations rather than just match them kind of in a static sense. Does that make sense? Do you see what I'm trying to say?
Yes. Yes, it makes sense. I want to, rather than just passively register information, make a difference. I wonder if there's a way to make this notion more precise, try to have a tentative definition of learning system. Do you have one?
Not really. Well, we have about five, and it depends on the physical model that we're trying to implement. I mean, this is something that it's fairly early days, and we're part, you know, some of the members of our team, and, you know, I'm sympathetic, although maybe less sympathetic than others, to this approach, and that is that we want it to be currently physically implementable. We want these things to be able to be built now with current technology so that we can actually do experiments and explore whether or not these things are possible. And I think if you limit yourself to that, then that in some senses defines how you're going to characterize what learning is and what your minimal causal agents are. And so we're kind of approaching it from a constructive, you know, we're constructing our minimal agent based under those constraints. But there is an opportunity to do what you're suggesting, and that is to think more, I guess from a more principled way, what is learning? What would we count as learning? And that's something that we definitely should do.
Thanks.
So there is a question in the chat, which mm-hmm. I will read. Maybe learning here can be defined as improving the solution to a specific optimization problem.
Okay, so, and that is something I did have some slides on optimization that disappeared. I guess one of the things that I did want to say is, you know, because we talk about the fact that in the quantum case, the learning is really driven by tunneling or spontaneous emission. So once you get down, you know, once you have a zero temperature, an agent that's in a zero temperature environment where the learning is, you know, the noise that drives the learning is by tunneling or fluctuations. So I wanted to draw a distinction between the kind of optimization learning that we do with systems like D-Wave, where the idea is to get down to a ground state and, you know, to perform some optimization task. Those models also use tunneling. The idea is, I think they're trying to implement unitary dynamics. What we're talking about is different. So we're in a far from equilibrium steady state. And there are a number of other works around this. Yamamoto and Mabuchi have done some really interesting work on looking at quantum optimizers, so optimizing using coherent icing machines as optimization machines in this kind of zero temperature environment. I was going to say something about that. In terms of thinking of learning causal information specifically as optimizing, I guess what you're trying to, I think that's probably right, but I suspect that actually probably what you're trying to optimize is the thermodynamic efficiency of whatever it is, whatever task it is that you're trying to achieve. I don't know how to characterize that carefully at the moment. There's several steps that you need to put in place to get that story correct. But you certainly can borrow a lot from the optimization literature from machine learning. So whoever that was in the chat, is there anything specific that you had in mind with that comment?
No, not really. My background is in economics, and I was trying to find a mapping between what you said and so, because an economic agent would always be an optimizing machine, mm-hmm. but with different efficiencies and with different goals in mind. And here, what you said that mapping, you know, minimizing actually the lost energy from the signal would be the goal. Yeah, that was it.
I see. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Rob?
Yeah, I have another one. So in the part of your talk where you're discussing the physics of learning, there were two kinds of claims. So, you know, on the one hand, you're interested to consider very concrete models which you could experimentally implement, which is, you know, would be nice, for example, if you wanted to show like a quantum advantage for learning using the same sorts of tricks that you use in quantum metrology. And so you said a fair bit about this sort of three-level atom sensor model and how that gives you a particular model of a perceptron and how to analyze that thermodynamically. But then there was also some claims that felt much more generic and foundational, mm-hmm. namely that every learning agent cannot be in thermal equilibrium. And in order to maintain its non-equilibrium state, it needs work. And then by fluctuation dissipation, that will impact the rate of learning. So I'm curious whether the abstract stuff that is model independent, whether you're trying to maybe distill that into a kind of theorem about rates of learning and trade-offs, because it sounds like you have that in mind, but you know, the concreteness of your model prevents you from well, at least for me, it's not clear how much of what you've said generalizes to any learning system.
Absolutely. And so for me personally, I'm definitely going for the general approach. I mean, you know, I don't have a background in characterizing those kind of quantum physical models. I rely on my coworkers to give me the details on that. What I'm looking for is to try and draw some lessons from those specific examples and then put them in more general terms. And, you know, that's taking a whole lot of learning on my behalf. But that is definitely the approach. And that is the aim from my perspective, is to look more at trying to draw some universal conclusions around the thermodynamics of learning, particularly causal learning, based on these kind of models. So it's a two-pronged approach. There is this kind of constructive approach looking at specific examples. I mean, and I guess, you know, I'm sure you've seen those general papers on quantum metrology where they, you know, they just talk about, you know, if we think about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and, you know, shot noise and, you know, there are these kind of very high level theoretical papers where you can say, you know, you don't actually have to have specific concrete models to be able to characterize what the quantum advantage is generally in metrological systems, you know, and whether you can get below shot noise, et cetera, that kind of stuff. So I think there's an opportunity there to do that, at least for the actuator sensor noise part. The harder task is that learning part. And I think maybe, you know, certainly from some of the work that Jared's done on quantum clocks, I can see that there are some general lessons that you might be able to draw from that, but that's the task.
Right.
Do we have more questions?
I have a question. You had a slide noting that a universe in which agents can learn will always appear to those agents that it's increasing in entropy. I thought that was a cute argument, but I'm curious whether you take it to be more than that. Like, do you think there could be anything like a fundamental to that argument? Or like it seems not fundamental to me, because presumably the change in entropy of the world is largely not governed by agents and their actions and their learning, but by, you know, stochastic processes. But yeah, I'm just curious what your take on that was, because it is kind of cute.
I think it might be able to be pushed beyond cute into semi-sensible. The way I would think about it is those perspectives that you have, David, about the world and being stochastic processes, and that our thermodynamic contributions, obviously very small, are all filtered through the lens of our learning. Everything we know about the universe has been learnt. You know, we can't understand anything about the universe without being learning agents in the first place. And there is this kind of curious, I mean, to me, it's like, you know, there are some things that just strike you as really curious in an almost conspiratorial way that forces you into this kind of anthropocentric thinking. So one of them is the no signaling in Bell correlations. You know, the fact that we can't use them to signal, that just seems really kind of conspiratorial and frustrating, and, you know, and there must be some deeper, you know, that it invites some deeper, more foundational way of thinking. And I would say it's the same here. I think it's curious that if we buy the argument that you cannot define learning without, you know, if you define learning from an entropic perspective where you regard entropy as being about information, we can't acquire new information without reducing the entropy outside, you know, the entropy of the environment. And I guess the confusing part here is whether or not is what you think about the philosophy of thermodynamics. Do you think that thermodynamic principles come from us as agents working in the world, and that, you know, it is a science of manipulations, and those manipulations are controlled and done by us, then, you know, maybe the fact that thermodynamics is a theory that makes sense also comes from the fact that we are, you know, we describe ourselves as agents learning in the world. It's a pretty big leap. I understand, you know, I understand why you would think of it as a kind of cute argument. I think Carlo Rovelli's thermal time hypothesis probably, you know, and a lot of what he's written, I think, would probably be sympathetic to the idea, at least of you know, the agent perspective and the way the agent is coupled to the world and learns gives us our unique perspective on arrows such as thermodynamic arrow and asymmetry and you know, second law, etc. And so I think if you know, there is an avenue for pushing those ideas into something foundational. I'm sympathetic to it. It's what I will be working on and thinking about.
Cool. Thanks.
Ding.
Sorry, I have another question.
Sure. More questions, the better.
Good. So I'm trying to draw a take-home lesson from the perspective of somebody who's familiar with these causal models. Mm. I like your point that they are abstract and maybe there's room for improvement. So I'm trying to compare with their content of agency and what I learned from your talk and see what they miss. One thing I also like about that you mentioned is you don't want to lose generality. I mean, these particular cases you presented, they're special cases and you're adding to something general. So I also want to try to see if you know, I have a general notion of agency incorporating these features you mentioned, what do they bring in comparison to the causal models? It seems they have a lot, actually. For example, if I have a quantum instrument that's depending on my choice, that must have an input system. It must have an output system. The quantum instrument must also depend on some choices of the agents. And translating to your language, maybe they relate to the sensor, which corresponds to the input system, and the actuator, which corresponds to the output system, and the learning system, which somehow relates to the choice of the quantum instrument. And it seems what they miss is first memory. If the quantum instrument is just one action without some persistence in time and without correlations among different actions. And the second thing they miss is thermodynamic considerations. Do you agree with this assessment? Is there something else they miss? Are the two things I mentioned something they do miss, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the third thing I would probably add to it, which is something that wasn't in my talk, but Lucien quite rightly raised it, and that is the fact that you want agents to agree. So you would want there to be some class of causal models that, regardless of where you're intervening, you know, where your agent is located spatiotemporally, they're going to agree. And then, you know, once you have communicating agents interacting and consider what kind of causal models or processes are available, you can ask yourselves questions about what happens in, you know, various general relativistic situations when you have curved space-time, what have you. There's a whole lot of work I know. There's been so many papers in the causal modeling work that there's a lot of stuff that I don't know, and maybe people are already doing this. But that would be the third thing that I would be considering.
Yeah, I agree. That's another important aspect. And thanks for the answer.
All right.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay. We had many questions. So let's thank Sally again.
Right now.